The readings from all three lessons this week are rich with sermon possibilities. And so when I thought about writing a sermon this week, I simply had trouble deciding what to preach on. But I thought after reading the reading from Genesis that my primary focus should be about the family. Because we hear today about a family and family arrangements that are considerably different than what we understand family to be in 2008 in this culture. It may resonate in certain parts of the world still, but certainly in the industrialized or technologicalized West, it is something that is remote from our experience. And I thought as I read both the reading from Genesis, but also Paul, one of the most optimistic passages in the New Testament about all things working together for good and the importance of God's presence and love to each of us, that might also have something to do with how we understand families functioning and its movement towards greater health and wholeness. And also in the gospel at the very end, where Jesus compares the kingdom as like a scribe, the responsibility, of a scribe is to be like someone who takes things that are old and new out of their treasury. And that's a commercial message for the tradition and its importance in our common life together. And God knows families have lots of traditions. Some of them are not altogether salutary, and we might talk about that in a minute as well. So let me say a word first about the reading from Genesis. Jacob is with a man named Laban, who has two daughters, Leah and Rachel. And he has fallen in love with Rachel and would like to marry her. Prior to this, Laban says, "Here you are with me. You shouldn't work for me for nothing. What would you like?" And he said, "I'd like to marry your daughter Rachel." And he said, "Well, if you work for me for 7 years, after you've completed this, you can marry Rachel." And so Jacob faithfully does this. And when the time comes, Laban says, "I'll deliver on my promise." And so they obviously must have had some kind of kick out the jams wedding celebration, because Jacob goes into the tent and wakes up in the morning and says, "It's Leah, not Rachel." So, I mean, he was either blacked out or blotto or something happened, right? What in the world went on? He said, "You tricked me. How could you do this?" Now, you know, this part of the story is what goes around comes around. That's what this is about. Jacob tricked his father, Isaac, into giving him the birthright that should have been Esau's. Esau agreed to this, by the way, because he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer and was hungry, not a man who was able to do much sort of self-regulation of instinctual drives. And so he agrees because he's hungry. But Jacob's mother conspires with Jacob to have this happen, to pull this deception off with her husband Isaac. And so now Laban has pulled the wool over Jacob's eyes, and he's there now married to Leah. So Laban says, in our culture, another thing about family, in this culture, we don't marry the youngest daughter before we marry the oldest daughter. It's not how we do it. So if you work for me for another 7 years, you can marry Rachel. Which he does, and he marries Rachel. So in one sense, it appears now that everything is okay. Now let me just say this. This is a story where neither of these women appear to have been consulted about this. Right? So you and I just say, well, that's consistent with the cultural milieu in which this story takes place, and that is true. But we can hardly use the biblical standard that we have received in this reading as something that could constitute anything remotely like a template that we would lay over what family means. Right? In fact, it is a reminder that there's more than one kind of family. Even in the ancient Near East. So when we hear a lot today about what it means to speak about family values, we have to ask ourselves just exactly which one in the Bible are we talking about here? And maybe we also need to comment on the fact that in the biblical witness, we have in the ancient Near East a world where there were plural understandings of family, just as we have today a world where there are plural understandings of what constitutes family. I have to tell you that the family values that are held up in this culture by some represent a particular model of family that any anthropologist or sociologist or historian would tell you is about 200 years old. The middle class bourgeois family in the United States didn't exist until about the 1820s at the earliest. Since 1815, in the United States, there has been a net migration off the farm. If any of you were raised on a farm, you know what farm life is like. And if the kids are on the farm and the family, the husband and wife are together all day long. The kids drive mom nuts. She sends them into the field to help dad and the workers. And she and the other women prepare the food for the men in the field and the workers. Farm life in the United States. The Industrial Revolution happens. Excuse me. And now we have mommy and daddy and baby makes three. The bourgeois family living home, dad working, mom at home. Becomes now the great model of the ages. Who said so? Now let me tell you something too, which may be overly psychobabbly. The same cause has paradoxical effects. You've heard me say this before. A child raised in a scrupulously neat family will either be a neatnik or a slob or something in between. Past experience is no predictor of future behavior in absolute terms, right? People who come from single-parent families turn out to go to Princeton in some cases. And people from intact families in the model that I just mentioned become drug addicts and ne'er-do-wells. It is no predictor of how we're going to turn out. How we're going to turn out is largely a function of the interior self-regulation that each of us learns to develop as we cope with the challenges and the opportunities that are in front of us on a daily basis. So the more that you and I learn how to remain non-anxious, the more we learn how to regulate our instinctual drives, the more we're able in some way to remain connected with our family of origin, but have the appropriate distance in order to become self-actualized, and a person, the more successful that we're going to be. And sometimes the kind of family values that we hear in this culture is the perpetuation and the baptizing of a type of interfamilial relationship that creates a situation where people don't know where they begin and end and others begin and end. And it has made a lot of people sick or crazy. All I'm saying is that you and I need to be very cautious about what we mean when we use the term family values. We have a plural understanding of family in this culture, and it's okay. Now, how do Christian people think about this? Because there are a lot of people who would claim, and I'm glad they do, that because of the conversion that they have experienced in the Christian faith and life, it has had a positive effect on their family life. It has made them more able to cope with the opportunities and challenges that all family life brings. And to look at a place that where family is understood to be the center but not the circumference of our lives and a necessity. And they have learned furthermore that through the generosity of spirit they've been able to express within their family, they have been able to rise above what an anthropologist would call kinship altruism, which means the focus exclusively of looking out for those nearest and dearest only, and not realizing that once that's done, the generous impulse can now be extended beyond the nuclear family, and that you can be faithful to the gospel of Christ by being generous as you reach out, and that that may constitute some real important family value that we would wish to advance. It is also important to say that those who are part of this plural understanding of family, who may be living styles of life or in arrangements that we have understood to be not traditional, wish to be part of the community of faith and to be faithful in their promises and to actually be intentional about their relationship and to say we take seriously the idea of commitment and that we are going to labor to see that these relationships thrive. Don't you think the church should be behind that? We ought to be saying we're in favor of any kind of faithfulness that we see operating in this culture at every level. Familial, workplace, friendship, any other way that you can describe. We're for it. We become evangelists for this kind of faithfulness. Now, what in the world can we look to help us in this process? Because no matter what kind of family arrangement in which you find yourself, you need some help. And some of the help that we get is described to us in the epistle today from Romans, where Paul speaks about the generosity of God as it is given to each person in terms of the presence of the Spirit of God, God coming in an inward way to enlighten and strengthen each of us. In some ways, this Spirit then becomes the strength that we can call upon to know that all things are working together for good for those who love God. Now, in the sermon discussion group earlier, an important thing was pointed out, because in some translations of the Bible, it's a more nuanced understanding of what it means when we hear God working together for good. Because it says God is working in every situation to transform things into good. So those of you who have experienced great tragedy in your life and adversity and difficulty know that God is laboring to bring all things towards a resolution that is good. And that if we start as a default position with God's unconditional love, acceptance, and forgiveness, then we know, as we seek to understand and cooperate with that, we see how things are brought together for good. So those of you who are saying, gee, I know people who've marched absolutely from one horror to the next, and there doesn't appear to be any relief here at all, we as people of faith hold, like Paul, the sure confidence that God is in fact working together for good. And by the way, we can see that made manifest in the life of families who move towards health and wholeness by paying attention to what they need to in their family lives. People who do this for a living, licensed marriage and family therapists, will say to you, the healthiest family is only symptom-free 70% of the time. So you may say, gee whiz, that's kind of a dire prediction. I take it as a great confident thing. It's not perfection that we're seeking, but progress. You know? So if a third of the time we got a little stuff to work on, that's okay. Because all of us are unfinished business, right? And we're learning as we do this to live into the promises of God. To touch that spirit that is within each of us that sighs too deeply for words. That passage means that when God is present to you, sometimes things have happened in your life where there are no words to describe them. You cannot give voice to them, but you know what they are. And by virtue of that, we know something about the presence and the power of God. Now, the third piece to this is what we get at the end of the gospel. That a scribe's responsibility. That means the custodian of the Word of God, a custodian of the deep things of Christian faith and belief as we hear and understand them, takes things out of the treasury that are both old and new. So maybe in a positive sense, you can be in your own family a repository of healthy corporate memory. There's an awful lot of corporate memory in families that I have found to be very faulty. Certainly in my own family. Have you ever been treated to things like, there's no divorce in this family? And then you do a little research and you find out, wait a minute, where does that come from? You know, maybe right here now there isn't any, but you know, Uncle Merritt and Aunt Charlotte and Aunt there was divorce. Right? So whose myth are we living? Right? And it governs the way people think. Little things govern the way people think. You know, we had a parishioner here many years ago, Don Skinner. Some of you may remember him. He said, my grandmother used to say in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when he was a kid growing up, well, you know, the Brewers, they eat garlic. And that meant a lot more than merely the fact of eating it, right? It said something about who they were. Just like in my family, if you said, well, you know, Doug Holmes' grandmother, she's a free thinker. That was not a compliment. We were to eschew free thinkers. But if you carry this with you as sort of a default understanding of every free thinker that you meet, it's going to kind of cramp your ability to be open to new possibility, isn't it? Among other things. And if you don't eat garlic, you're missing out on a lot. Did you know it thins the blood? So this week, see if you can be an instrument for health and wholeness in your family. Give thanks to God for the multifaceted aspect of family that we see at play in the history of humanity. Understand that you and I should be in favor of supporting, with God's love, health and wholeness, all forms of family that seek to be faithful and intentional. See if you have the opportunity to access the Spirit of God, God coming in an inward way to enlighten and strengthen you, which is always a free resource that you can call on. And finally, take seriously your responsibility to be a custodian of the tradition and to take out of your store of practical wisdom both things that are old and things that are new. Amen.